Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we're talking about Rude Mech's Lipstick Traces with Sean Sides and Lana Leslie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks.
So, for people who maybe haven't had a chance to get to this fantastic book yet, this is a graphic novel based on a stage show that Rude Mech's did and then toured for many years, which is itself based on a 450-page work of cultural criticism. Am I more or less getting that right?
Yes. That is accurate.
Great. Great. And I think it's, there's sort of a nice form and function thing of the chain of transmission for how this book came to be is, almost as convoluted as the train of transmission traced in the original book. But I'm sure we'll get a little bit more into that later. So this is a production by Rude Mech's, which is an Austin-based theater company that you two are both members of. Is that how the company works?
We're a collective. So Sean and I are two of the seven people that co-founded the company, and we are two of the five current co-producing artistic directors.
Great. And Sean also directed the piece, right?
Yes.
Great. Great. And Sean, did you perform in it as well?
Oh, heck no.
Heck no.
Lana did.
Okay. Lana did. I know. Yes. why do you say, oh, heck no?
Why do I say, oh, heck no? I feel like I really needed to be on the outside for that one. I feel like I always kind of need to be on the outside. I am just not very good at being in it and directing it at the same time. So, it's happened since then, like with Method Gun, but usually it's because I've directed somebody else into the role first, somebody else originated it, and then I just sort of understudy them, like copy what they did. So, just because I think it's possible. I think there are amazing people out there who can both direct and perform in a thing, but I ain't one of them, I'm afraid. Gotta get either inside or outside.
Yeah, it's good to have some outside perspective, I think, on most types of theater projects. I think that's true. And the five of you, do you have sort of permanent roles as I'm a director, I'm a performer, I'm a playwright, I'm a dramaturg, or do you kind of switch hats depending on the needs of the production? How does that work?
Nothing is permanent.
Yeah. We have things that we all personally feel we are better at than other things. And we also have, opinions about each other and what we think we're all better at, but we are all free to do whatever we decide we want to do on any production.
Great. Hopefully those opinions line up at least most of the time.
They do. They
That's
do.
Good. That's
most
very good.
Of the time.
We're not entirely deluded.
Just a little bit deluded. Just enough. Just the right amount of deluded.
You got to be at least a little deluded. Could you tell us a little bit about kind of how you started the group? What was the kind of founding vision? What's the, you know, what was the impetus of let's form a theater company?
Well, back in 1993.
Oh, no, it was in 94.
Yeah, we all, a lot of the people who, six of the seven co-founders, all went through this program in the English department at the University of Texas called Shakespeare at Wynedale, where you study Shakespeare through performance. And we didn't all do it at the same time, but we, several of us did it together at different times. And that, I think, is the sort of, that I think helped us understand flatness, like how to create a sort of non-hierarchical collaboration, because there is no real director out there at Wynedale, you know, 19 people put on a Shakespeare play together and they do everything. They do the lights, the costumes, they direct each other, they perform, they crew, and they're doing it all within the play itself. You know, you run from the stage to the light booth to do your scene of in the light booth, and then you run down and hand somebody an ice pack because it's an outdoor theater in Texas summer. So that sort of taught us that we really enjoyed, I think, collaboration in a way that I don't think back then people who were studying theater in college got to experience. And so that was sort of a foundational idea for the company.
I have a question that I hope won't seem impertinent, but why did you decide to stay in and found a company in Austin?
How dare you?
Which is a great, I mean, I want to be very clear. I'm in the bag for Austin. I have family in Austin. It's a cool town, but you know, most people who decide to try to make it in the theater, don't go to Austin. Maybe they should go to Austin, but why did you just, is this a rude question? You can tell me if it is.
I mean, I think it really, the key phrase there was make it, like make it in the theater. And I think that was something that we all, none of us had any pretense about. Like we weren't trying to get our plays on Broadway or be famous Broadway actors or even be famous, you know, downtown New York theater actors or whatever. We talked about it a lot, you know. Sean went off to grad school in New York. Sarah, one of the other co-founders, went off to grad school in California. And Kirk and I had moved to New York, which is actually where we met Sean. And we did, the one play there. And it was like, oh, that cost us everything we had. And literally no one came. And a junkie took a crap on the on the theater entrance. So that
on
sucked.
Opening night, Kirk on opening cleaned it night. Up with a paper towel.
Wow. I thought that was a sort of salty old New York, you know, that's a real thing that happened. That's
true.
Yeah, that totally happens. Okay. So when we decided to start the company in Austin, we talked a lot about like, you know, how much support we already have here. We could start with a board of directors of people that we know and love and trust. We have a donor base already because we've all been here for so long. Austin is also called the Velvet Rut, and especially back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was, why would you leave? You know, my rent was like $250 a month for a huge one bedroom in a really amazing part of town. Like there was, you could actually work very little and survive and make art, you know, like work day job type jobs, and not kill yourself to make rent so that you had time to make art. So that was, I don't know if any of those sentences made any sense.
No, that totally, that absolutely made sense. I went to Arizona School for the Arts for high school, and I spent a lot of time hanging around the punk scene in Phoenix, as a kid. And that was like why people stayed in Phoenix was my rent is $300 and I work 10 hours a week at a coffee shop.
That's right.
Like,
yeah.
Why would I leave?
Like, living the dream. Yeah.
Yeah. Living the fucking dream, no doubt.
Cool. And then how long was, I mean, so this play, Rude Mex, toured quite extensively. Was it the first show that you really toured, or how did you, you know, how did you go from being a cool company making cool stuff in your town to
Thank
being a company that was touring
cool.
all over the time? Oh, for sure. Rudemex is cool. This is known.
Oh my God.
We really lucked out. It was the first play that we ever toured. We didn't even really know we wanted to tour. But there was a guy who invited us to go with him and his theater company to New York to the Ice Factory Festival at the Ohio Theater. That was our first time to like take our work anywhere. And we only had a workshop version of the play. It was like a 40-minute long version. And Kirk was literally writing Manic History like on the plane. So it was still just being, you know, put together even. We didn't have any designers with us or anything. It was kind of a hot mess. And then from there, we realized that it was kind of a thing that we should focus on. And then the Midwest Arts Conference came to Austin the next year when we were actually finishing up this play. So Sarah Richardson, one of the artistic directors, was the brainchild behind really making sure that she got all of the presenters that were here for the Midwest Arts Conference to our theater to see Lipstick Traces. And she got a lot of people to see it. And it was out of that that we developed a relationship with Melanie Joseph and Philip Byther and Chuck Helm. So Philip Byther really was the one who sort of put together we did like a 4-venue tour to the Walker, the Wexner, to CSPS 21, and then to Diverse Works. And that was thanks to Philip, like helping us. We didn't know really how to do it. So he really put that together and got those presenters involved. And then Melanie, meanwhile, was working on putting together producing rights so that she could produce it in New York for a real 6-week run. And then she took it on a tour to the West Coast and to Austria. So we went to like Seattle and LA and then Austria with it, with the Foundry. But it actually, like, we were really hoping it would tour a lot more. But it, you know, it didn't.
I mean, the Sex Pistols only had one American tour, so maybe that's appropriate.
Thank you. Yes, that's perfect.
That comment, I realize, will make no sense to anybody who doesn't know what the show is about. I mean, so like getting into this show in particular, Lipstick Traces by Greil Marcus is like one of the craziest books I've ever read. And I feel like I'm a guy who is known to read a crazy book, but this is like a truly I was talking about it with my partner, and I said, and you know, they were sort of like, well, what's this giant book you've been reading for 3 weeks? And I was like, well, it's about how the Sex Pistols are sort of the latest incarnation of a secret tradition of like nihilism going back to the Gnostics. And my partner just sort of paused and said, like, do you think that's true? Which is like not a book you ask, like not a question you ask about most works of history. I mean, it's, you know, it's published by Harvard University Press.
Yeah.
And yet, like, it's a book you can very legitimately ask, like, is this all bullshit? So what possessed you to try to make a play out of this insane book?
Well, this is Sean talking. Both Kirk and I had worked in bookstores in our early-ish years, our like just post-college years. And it was flying off the shelf. And it was an important book. Certainly, I think it still is. But certainly at that time, like late 80s, early 90s, it was the cool book to have. I mean, and it's like you're a dorky nerd who works in a bookstore, but there's this really smart book that has Johnny Rotten on the cover. Like, yeah, of course I'm going to read that, or at least mostly read a lot of parts of it. I eventually did read it before we did the play. I really did a deep, hardcore read before we started rehearsal. But when we first decided to do the play, I don't think I had actually read it all the way through every word.
I don't think that Kirk had either quite yet. Like, it was in the house. Like, it was still just in the house, you know? Like,
but the book being read. Yeah, it invites, you know, needle dropping inside there. You don't, it doesn't.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it doesn't require you to start at the, on page one and go to the end. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think it was kind of a dare a bit among us all. It's like, oh, right, here's this book that we've all read-ish, and we all love the parts that we've read. I dare you to do it. No, I dare you to do it.
Yeah, no, I'm gonna say nobody but Kirk and Sean had even read even parts of that book. It was leap of faithy on the rest of our parts. We were like, okay, if y'all want to do that, cool. I guess I'll start reading it now. You know, that was very leap of faithy on the rest of our parts. Just the two of them were like, I dare you, I dare you, I dare you.
I was one time at a party in college, and I was talking about books with some book nerds. And one of the book nerds said that his favorite book was Gravity's Rainbow. And I said, oh, nice. I just finished that book. Yeah, really crazy book. And he was like, whoa, you finished it? after telling me it was his favorite book. I think that's, List of Traces is kind of that kind of book. I read it because my cool uncle recommended it to me.
Huh.
Other than Kirk wanting to do it and you guys sort of being pulled along and then agreeing to do it. Did you have any experience in punk? I mean, was that important to you? It's like what maybe a third of the book is about.
Yeah. I want to say that I wanted to, I think, like, there's sort of a tug of war about which one of us, Kirk or me, decided we wanted to do the book first. I just want to get that in there. I mean, come on, man, Kirk. Get out of here. He's not even here.
He's not on the call.
Himself.
Yeah, sure. That's say whatever right. you want about Kirk.
I will say that I think punk was much more important to Kirk in his kind of growing up years than it was to me. I think it would be to me. And I have some like good, important stories. But I grew up in this tiny, small town, and I just didn't have access to the Sex Pistols. Like, if they didn't play it on, you know, 97 FM, I had no access. So it wasn't a part of my formative high school years. There was this very cool guy who was a lot like Matthew McConaughey in Dazed and Confused.
Sure.
Then I was riding in that guy's car one time in high school, and he put on some music, and it was the craziest thing I'd ever heard in my life. I couldn't believe it. And everybody just sort of froze and stared at the stereo and said, "What is that?" And he said, his name was Chase Elliott. Of course it was. And Chase Elliott said, "That's the Sex Pistols." And yeah. So that, I have a strong memory of that. But as for like in my really early formative years, I got no punk cred. I can't claim it. I later, a little bit later, a little bit here and there. But yeah. What about you, Lana?
I had two older sisters, one of whom was like the music buff, the sort of catalog she could index, you know, with the best of them. And so as close as I ever got to punk was through her. And as close as she ever got to punk was a deep abiding obsession with Patti Smith. But she never drifted over into Sex Pistols or... and then I think like later I sort of have that guy experience. Like there was a friend in high school who introduced me to punk rock. But it wasn't anything I was like, you know what? I'm going to go out and buy all that shit right now. I just listened. It was like, well, that's cool. Okay.
Right. And this was all, of course, pre-Riot Girl.
Yeah, this was in the 80s, like the early 80s.
Yeah.
I had a friend in middle school who wrote the Sex Pistols on her jeans in Sharpie. That's how I
learned. Wow. Yeah. She was cool.
Yeah, Laurel Lundgren. Shout out to Laurel Lundgren.
Way to go.
Yeah, she was cool. That's awesome. So one element from the show that it doesn't have a sort of direct analog in the book is there's a sort of second narrator character that Lana that you played. Lana's narrative character sort of played off Malcolm McLaren, the legendary manager of the Sex Pistols and also the Clash, I think. And they sort of seem to represent something. What do you think they represent? Why are there two narrators and what how does that work?
Lana?
I don't know.
Lana, in my thesis production when I was writing a thesis, we all made a play together that was a deconstruction of Taming of the Shrew, and Lana invented this character, Dr. Narrator, and Dr. Narrator is dry and smart and really, really has important things like to say and to share with you. And I don't know. I don't want to talk too much about the character because like you made it up, but it was,
I mean, I'm going to just jump in. I feel like part of the reason that, is that we needed some kind of, first of all, we wanted a woman to be in the fucking play. Like we just wanted at least one woman.
Not a lot of women in this book.
Not a lot of women in this play, not a lot of women in the history, you know, Greal shouts out to the occasional woman who was a part of each of the movements, if there was one. But so we just wanted that voice, like and then B, we wanted a counter narrative. One of the things that's fun about the book is that you do ask, like, is this fucking true? And I think that is that's a sort of vibe that we wanted to keep in the production itself. So having an argument about whether things happened a certain way or not going between two different narrators, so you aren't quite sure, was the idea, I think. So to set Malcolm up as telling his own story, but to have somebody next to him going, that's not exactly what happened. No, the whole time sets up some kind of tension that I think was necessary.
And then you have Johnny Rotten kind of come on towards the end and give his side of the story.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I feel like your book captures really well about Greal Marcus's book is that like the whole thing, like the chain of transmission is pretty solid from the Gnostics to Malcolm McLaren. And then the only thing that's like, is this real or is this not? Is like, do you believe that Malcolm McLaren gave Johnny Rotten a book and that he read it?
Like, so true.
That's the weakest link in the chain.
Yeah.
And you have Johnny Rotten pretty much, you know, he's kind of deflating Malcolm McLaren's myth of, you know, yes, I orchestrated this whole grand thing. And Johnny Rotten's like, no, you didn't. I wrote the songs. They're about I'm angry at everything. I decided to call myself Johnny Rotten. And that's part of the play too, is that like the question of like, is this actually a tradition? Does it need to be a tradition, or is it enough if it's just like, if the sort of hegemonic superstructure is set up this way, then there will always be sort of the negative of that that somebody decides to express and says, no, I'm not gonna work is boring, I'm gonna do what I want, that's more fun.
Yeah, but also, I mean, that's pretty reductive.
Right. No, yeah, I know.
I love that voice. I think that voice is the most important voice that happens every time it pops up in a generation, is to go, wait, it's the critical thinking voice. It's the, no, it doesn't have to be this fucking way. No, it doesn't have to. I'm not going to do that. Like, I love that because we're sheep otherwise, and I don't want to be sheeple. I always have that voice.
And do you think that's really that what you just beautifully articulated there? That's like the real answer to like why this book, why this project?
I think so. I mean, for me personally, like that's my connection to it anyway. It's my personal, like why I could stand doing that play, you know. Creating a play from scratch is like a long, really difficult, arduous, it's in terms of theater making, not in terms of like jobs you could have in the world, but in terms of theater making, it is a long, arduous, kind of painful process. And you have to find your way into a project that connects you there and will keep you there. And that idea was, I think, my connection to it.
I found the way you portrayed Guy Debord really funny. do you want to talk about him a little bit?
I mean, Sean, I think that's all you. I really didn't have.
You know, honestly, I have to give a lot of props to Kirk on that one. Are you thinking about? When he's at the cafe table or when he's doing his movie?
More the movie, I guess, which is just so, Could you want to talk about what this movie is?
Right. So we...
En faveur de Sade.
Oh, I'm so glad you remembered that title. Oh, I guess because you were drawing it. Yes. All right. So the book touches on various events and... I think even subconsciously, I don't even think we knew what we were doing, but we would gravitate toward things that were actual events that could be staged. Of course, that's what we did, duh. But I don't think we actually consciously knew that's what we were doing.
Good impulse, Sean. That's smart.
It's really true. I'm going to just pause you just to say, like, one of the very first thing we did as a group, there were like 13 of us at the table at the beginning of this process, was divide the book up into sections. And each person was charged with going to read the section and then staging something from that section. Or writing something, not staging it, but like writing a thing that could be staged. So I think that's how we ended up sort of unconsciously gravitating towards things that were actual events.
So, you know, Cabaret Voltaire and Michel Moir taking over the cathedral. And then the screening of this Guy Debord film that was just a blank screen. Which to me is hilarious. And people watched it and they stayed. And
it goes on for a while in the graphic novel. How long did it go on for in when you actually did it?
I feel like in real life, how long did it go on?
No. In the production.
Play? Oh. It sort of depended on whether Guy and I were going to be like how deep we were going to dig into that. Like if the audience was willing, we would take a really long time. I feel like I expressed the time right in the book.
Yeah.
Like that's how it felt to me. And things always feel faster on stage even. But like if you look at each frame individually and like sit with it for as long as you would any other frame, that feels like how long it took.
Yeah. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I love how you explore that idea of duration, because so much of what makes theater fun is things like duration and timing and surprise, which are like hard to do in a medium that's not a time-limited medium. But I feel like that sequence is a really genius way to do that, where you just show Guy Debord sitting there smoking for a while, like for just like, you know, 20 or so frames, and the narrative being like, is it over? What, is it still going on?
Yay, that's one of my favorite sections of the book, so I'm happy it works for you.
This reminds me actually of a quote that I wrote down that he says, that Guy Debord says, where he says, "And what is history anyway? It drifts mostly. Is it simply a matter of events leaving behind things that can be measured? What about those moments that drift by, leaving nothing behind?" I mean, in a way, that's sort of the challenge of this book, is how do you take something that is a performance and try to capture more about it than just the words that you said.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Wait, was that a question?
No, I mean, it should have been. I didn't ask a question.
Yes, but, no, I'm in complete agreement with you about that. That wonderment.
Yeah. I guess that was a good time as any to transition to the kind of that topic is. So 53rd State Press, wonderful theater publisher, reached out to you, right, and said, "We want to do some kind of a book about Rude Max, about some show." I don't know what they said. tell us about that process.
They did. I know what they said. They Great. Were they connected with Kirk, I think, and wanted to know if we wanted to publish any of our plays, like one of our plays. And we, of course, wanted to. Our play that everybody knew the best, Method Gun, had already been published because it was in Humana Festival. And then it was also published in Play, a journal of plays. So we decided we wanted something a little more representative of all of our stuff that we loved. So we talked about doing three plays in the publication, and they said yes. So it would include Method Gun and then a play that we created called Requiem for Tesla, and then Lipstick Traces. And they were really cool about that. And then it just sort of evolved. I was put in charge of Lipstick Traces, like figuring out what we were going to do. We had several meetings about like how we wanted to approach these books, looking at all the other stuff that had been published by 53rd State Press and all the really cool, cool books our peers had put out. And, you know, how did we want to enter into that catalog? And it just sort of winnowed down to Lipstick Traces over time. And I kind of had just like a vision of it. I tried to find people who could draw to do it for a little while. And then I was like, I am so type A and I'm just going to boss this artist. And I just need to figure out how to draw so I can just do what I see in my head. And then I was like, it is, you know, it's about this whole DIY movement anyway. So it doesn't have to be great. It can be shitty. And that gave me the freedom to do it, to just decide that it could be as shitty as it was going to be. And it was still going to be the thing I made. And it would be very representative of the play.
Yeah. I want to stipulate it. It's not shitty and you did a great job.
Thank you.
And I do feel, I think you're drawing on the aesthetic of like punk zines, and that shows, and it's like, you know, it's, you can see the Sharpie lines even when it's the black space. That's very cool. But like, it looks great. When I first heard about this book, I just assumed that you like were a graphic novelist and you also did theater. But that's, I mean, so like I draw a little, I do like dumb little cartoons, and drawing graphic novels is like a famously labor intensive art form. Did you know that?
I did not know that. No, I just had
like there's like a whole Art Spiegelman book where he just talks about how hard it is to make graphic novels.
He's just such a wimp. I mean, I found it so easy. No, I had no idea what I was getting myself into at all. And it took like, you know, over time, because I had a job already and was making plays this whole time and touring and stuff. It took a long time to get it done. It took me like 3 years to get it done, because I would pick it up for 6 weeks and then put it down for a year, you know, pick it up for another 2 weeks and put it down for 3 months or whatever. And I also had several false starts. Like I didn't know how to do it. So I had to learn how. And I started at the beginning, like, so that opening monk, scene was just like the bane of my existence for the better part of a year until I figured out. And then I just decided to go forward with the book. And I kept going back and trying it. And so it ended up being one of the last things. I think it's one of the best like pieces of art in the book. And it's because it's one of the very last things I did. Like I learned a whole bunch before I could figure out how to do that one scene.
Can you talk about your process of that a little bit? I mean, like, how did you learn how to make graphic novels?
My partner, Peter, does a lot of drawing. He's actually really good at it, and I should have just made him do the book. he really inspired me, because he does a lot of like printing something out and then printing it out again and again and again and messing with it and distorting it and then drawing from there. I wanted to represent the play when it was at the Southern Theater in Minneapolis, because that theater is just so gorgeous. Of all the venues we did it in, that was the one I wanted to represent in the book. That's my one like sadness about this rendering of it, is that I never did quite get the theater itself across very well. I used our videotape from that show, I don't understand perspective at all. In fact, I may not have any, like depth perception or, you know, I just couldn't figure out how to draw anything to scale. And so I printed out, frames of each scene and then, reverse them and put them into a negative so that I had an outline of the stage so that I would always have the scale right, no matter which angle I was using. So I used the videotape from the play to print out and then drew from there. So I always had a shape of a person, at least like an outline of them. Rarely did I have their features or their clothes or anything in there. So a lot of it is just like a big old, you know, Sharpie coloring book. And the art part of it for me was deciding like what style the drawings needed to be in to sort of best evoke what was happening in that scene. Was it all just sort of dark and big fat Sharpies, or was it really like line drawn? Was it really dynamic, or was it really still? Those kinds of things. Like 18, that was like the second hardest thing to figure out how to do. Johnny Rotten's Audition.
Singing Alice Cooper's 18.
Yeah.
Which is another event.
An event that we staged.
Yeah.
Did I answer your question? I just started rambling. Yeah,
definitely. And it seems to me like I probably sort of unconsciously picked up on this reading the graphic novel, but it seems like a lot of what you're doing with pacing has to do with line, right? Like the scenes where things are happening really quickly, it's a lot of white. It's a lot of thin lines. And the scenes where things are slow are darker, are thicker lines. Was that conscious?
I don't know. I don't think that was conscious, like what the darkness and the light, like I really, 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 I think this is like almost it's in my mind, at least, an homage to Brian Scott's lighting design. I really tried to make you see it. So if there is a lot of white, that is because Brian put some big squares down on the stage and I tried to make it go. Yeah, it's mostly about like his lighting, what you're seeing.
Supposedly like that's what it looked like. So that's what you drew.
Yeah. Yeah. Like cool. I want you to see what it was like as much as possible.
Was there, yeah, that's an interesting comment. Was there ever a thought about like, you know, what if you drew a representation of Johnny Rotten's audition singing Alice Cooper's 18 instead of drawing an actor like playing Johnny Rotten, like reenacting Johnny Rotten's audition, right? Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, totally. And that I went down that path, like that was what I was talking about like learning how to do the graphic novel. Cause I like one of my favorite books is Alice in Sunderland. And it's so that's sort of what I wanted to do is like have the narrator character be in color and then have everything else be in this real inky sort of zany black and white punky like wash and to just collage together like, you know, like for Michelle Moore's Riot at Notre Dame to like collage together all these images of him being like hung in this basket and the church and the bells. And, you know, I just had all kinds of crazy big vision for it that I just can't draw. Like, I can't draw that. I don't know how to draw. It's not me being modest. It is like straight up the truth. It would have taken, I would have had to have gone to art school and then tried to do the book. So I decided, and then I was grateful for not being able to draw because it did bring me back to the original intent, which was to like publish the script. And then the idea that theater is so ephemeral and that, you know, if you went and saw the play, it really just exists in your mind. And how can we create some kind of permanent artifact that is representative of the actual performance. And that became the goal, was to really to pull out the Minneapolis tape and to really look at that and decide that it's like super worthy of being recorded. The action of that play and the people in that play are super worthy of being recorded as much as the text, which is not representative at all of what actually the experience of seeing it live is.
And I think there's something I don't quite know. I'm not smart enough to know why this is, but it feels to me like the book that you made, Lana, is a closer document of what it felt like to go to the show than actually watching the video.
That's the goal.
Yeah,
that makes me super happy.
Well, I think that it happens, and I do not understand why or how, but it has something to do with what reading is and how, like what happens in your mind as you're looking at it, at the drawings and the page, as opposed to watching a video, which is more passive somehow. I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense. I think it's sort of about like, you know, when you're reading something, part of what you're doing is like completing it in your head.
Yeah.
And that's also part of theater. And it's not part of watching a movie. Like when you're watching a movie, like are they giving you everything?
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Huh. Let's see what else. Oh yeah. That's another question I wanted to ask. Does the graphic novel contain the whole script, or did you edit down the content of the performance when you were making the graphic novel?
No, it's the whole thing. Down to the like ers and ums.
What was it like for you? I mean, like, I think it would be mortifying watching yourself so many times.
I only really had to watch myself once. And then just print that shit out and stop listening and watching. I actually really like our kind of group performance of the Minneapolis at the Southern Theater more than any other performance, because it was our first time to tour and we were at a hugely important venue, like the Walker Arts Center. It was like a hugely important moment for our company. And we were all just like baby actors who just, we were grownups, but you know, we were just scared and had like this crazy energy. And you, I think, can just smell it on us in the performance, even in the video of it. I have no idea what I was answering now.
It's fine. Do you feel like now that you've made a graphic novel, do you feel like that's something that you want to pursue more? Or do you feel like I'm never going to spend 3 years of my time drawing something in Sharpie ever again?
I mean, I actually really, really enjoyed that process. And if I didn't have anything else to do to make a living, I would absolutely, and I could make a living doing that, or, you know, put food on the table. I would love to do that to all of our plays. It's hugely rewarding. And also, it's just a different kind of creativity. Like, one of the reasons I really loved this project was that it was something that I just, it was a piece of art that I made on my own after like 20 years of collaborating, just at, and still collaborating throughout the process of making the book. I found like a little side project that was really mine that I didn't need to like run by anybody or talk to anybody about really. Like, I'm really lucky. My colleagues just gave me free rein to do whatever I wanted with this piece of art we all made together. And just let me, you know, have fun with it on my own, which I absolutely did. It was a blast to make.
Yeah. And then, and at the same time, preserving the show as a graphic novel rather than a script does, like you said, sort of allow the other members of the company to have their, to be recorded as well. And not just having it be, you know, all about the playwright.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Do you feel like this show and the experience of making the show and touring the show changed the company at all?
Absolutely. It was a giant shift for us to enter the national scene and meet all of the people that we've gotten to meet over the years because of that. It was Lipstick Traces that put us there for sure.
What about internally? Do you feel like spending all this time with, you know, punks and situationists and Dadaists changed the way you made work?
Oh, interesting. I think making the play, in, like every play we make, influences the way we make the next one. Kirk says often our next process is an apology for the last one. As we try to heal the wounds we've inflicted on one another.
So true.
How could it not, I guess? Is if there's way where it explicitly has, I don't know what that way is. But I can't imagine having all those people, Guy Debord and Johnny Rotten and Michel Moore and John of Leiden and Greil Marcus and evil Malcolm McLaren. He wasn't evil. Just a little bit evil Malcolm McLaren in our heads so early and for so long and so intensely didn't shape or misshape something inside all of us, right?
Do you have like favorite characters from the show?
I mean, I just very much love Guy Debord and in the show. Of all of the people that are in the play, is that what you meant?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it really what you meant?
I don't know. Like, I think that's an interesting question. Is like, is it, you know, are you playing historical figures? Or are you playing a character who also is named Guy Debord and also, you know, shows this weird blank movie? How much did you try to like, act like these characters? How much did you try to like, right? Or how much did you give yourself permission to be like, this is a play. Everybody knows that I'm not you know,
different actors had different approaches to it. You know, like when T. Ryder Smith, I think all, every single actor that took on a character understood the Rude Max desire for there always to be a layer of themselves present in the piece. And, you know, we call each other by our first names in there so that we're not trying to convince the audience that this is actually Tristan Zara or Richard Hulsenbeck, that it's, you know, Robert Pearson playing Richard Hulsenbeck or T. Ryder Smith playing Richard Hulsenbeck. And then I think there are some of, like, when Gavin Mundy, who originated the role of Guy Debord, I don't think for a second Gavin ever as an actor was like, and now I'm going to do my best Guy Debord. Like, what Gavin was going to do was put on his best, worst French accent and deliver the text as a sophisticate. Like, that, I think, you know, was his idea. And then James Urbaniak becoming Guy Debord, or I feel like almost had the exact same approach. But then the people who were playing Malcolm McLaren and Johnny Rotten, I feel like they felt, because those are characters that the public, the theater going public, has a connection to, they felt more responsibility to be closer to the actual person. But, you know, nobody knows what Richard Hulsenbeck was like. Nobody hung out or saw Guy Debord really that much, you know.
Yeah.
Michelle Moore, like, you can do whatever you want and it's going to feel like an accurate historical sort of rendering of that character. But Johnny Rotten and Malcolm McLaren, I think they felt some pressure.
People know what they kind of sound like and
stuff. Yeah.
I couldn't help but noticing that a big part of the book that's not in the show is the Derivé, which is a Guy Debord thing where you get very drunk and wander around.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think about, like, why is that on the show? Was it?
It was. Oh, we took it out. About this.
It was. Yeah.
Because it's not an event? Because it's inherently boring to look at? Why'd you take it out?
I guess maybe that was it, that it wasn't an event.
But no, it's actually like melded into that post-film part. Like, because we had that whole floor pattern for the Derivé, and I remember that. And so that speech, It Drifts Mostly, is I think, mm-hmm. actually a reference to the Derivé that we had before we kind of cut that scene. And mm-hmm. so there's a tiny little hint of that floor pattern in the play that's staged to that speech, the It Drifts Mostly.
Cool.
That is actually the Derivé.
That became that.
But you can't tell. The book is almost, it's impossible because I just have us all standing still essentially in the book. But
yeah,
he does do it. It's almost in complete darkness and he drifts around the stage making that speech.
I remember early on, like, that was a scene that we still had in the play when we were rehearsing for the Ice Factory Festival at the Ohio. And we were at the Ohio, like, working on that scene and those characters and, like, the actors, like, it was like, okay, just, like, do the frug. It was a lot of fruging.
I remember a lot of fruging.
I don't know why we were fruging, but that got caught.
I can't imagine why we cut that.
I may be showing my ignorance here, but what is fruging?
The frug, it's a dance. It's that 60s dance where, like, how can I describe this? You keep your elbow. Ooh, Pee Wee Herman would probably do this dance. You keep
There's a lot of Goldie Hawn, I think.
Closish to your torso, and you kind of hitchhike twice over to the right, and you hitchhike twice over to the left. Does this seem like something you can picture?
Yeah, more or less. Sure. did Greil Marcus ever see the show?
He did.
Yeah, he saw it a bunch.
Oh, cool. What did he say?
He's so cool. He wrote us a letter after the first time he saw it. That's maybe the nicest thing that's ever been written to our theater company in all of its bajillion years.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Which was just like, you did the thing I was trying to do with my book. It was like that cool. It was longer and it had a lot more words in it, but that's essentially what he said that, like, blew us away.
Yeah. You would think a letter from Greil Marcus would be long.
It was not. It was like, it was a couple couple of paragraphs and it was like really, really nice. But I mean, he also, you know, we hung out with him and have stayed in touch. You know, I emailed him to get permission to do the graphic novel. And he was like, it's yours. Do whatever you want. I can't wait to see it. Like, that's how cool he has been from the beginning to the end of this whole journey. Ooh, I said journey.
I feel like I think it's fine. Journey sometimes is a word. I'm kind of weirdly like a 70s rock music criticism nerd. And I feel like Greil Marcus is like one of the only dudes from that generation that you're like pretty sure he's not just going to say something horrible. Like, he's like just a good dude who had good opinions about things. And like, maybe you won't like a record he liked, but he's not just going to say something like totally weird and, you know, awful.
I feel like he has never said anything weird or awful.
Well, no, I mean, listen, I could pull quotes from any of the other guys and you would say, yeah, that's a horrible thing to say. I can't do that with Greil Marcus.
Yeah.
I saw him at a jazz show once. He was having a really good time. He was like cool.
Yeah. Huh? No, what? What was he doing?
He was standing up. It was an outdoor show. He could have sat down, but he was standing up and he was just bopping his head and just like really into it. And it was such a sweet moment of like, oh, this dude's been writing about music for 50 years and still just loves music.
Yeah. Right. How is he not like music? Ugh.
Yeah.
I hate you forever. No. He really. So when you say he's not going to say something terrible, do you mean like dumb or do you mean like nasty?
Mostly I mean like racist or sexist or dismissive of black music or, you know, there's like a lot of that that goes around.
Oh God.
For sure there is.
There's like
super decent man.
Yeah. He like doesn't really do interviews, but he flew out to London to interview the Raincoats after he heard their first album. That's a cool thing to do.
That's a super cool thing to do.
He said Slater Kinney was the best rock band in the world. Yeah. Like, that's that. Yeah. How cool must that have been for them? I mean, he's not wrong. They're probably the best rock band in the world, but
still.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Is there anything I should have asked you that I haven't asked you or anything else you want to talk about that we haven't talked about?
I don't think so. I mean, the book is available on 53rd State Press and on our website. If anybody wants to get out there and grab a copy, it's still in print. There's plenty out there. That's all I can think of.
Sean?
I guess our website is rudemex.com. There's that there.
Right. Gotta get the plugs in before the end.
Yeah. I think that's all.
Well, cool. Thanks so much for being on the show, guys.
This was so really much fun.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book.